Hackworth departs from Dr. X's laboratory. Further ruminations. Poem from Finkel McGraw. Encounter with ruffians. Dr. X's assistant swung the door open and nodded insolently. Hackworth swung his top hat into place and stepped out of the flea circus, blinking at the reek of China. Smoky like the dregs of 100 million pots of Lapsang Souchong, mingled with the sweet, earthy smell of pork fat and the brimstony tang of plucked chickens and hot garlic. He felt his way across the cobbles with the tip of his walking stick until his eyes began to adjust. He was now poorer by several thousand yukus, a sizable investment, but the best a father could make. Dr. X's neighborhood was in the Ming Dynasty heart of Shanghai, a warren of tiny brick structures sheathed in gray stucco, topped with tiled roofs, frequently surrounded by stucco walls. Iron poles projected from the second-story windows for drying clothes, so that in the narrow streets the buildings appeared to be fencing with each other. This neighborhood was near the foundation of the ancient city wall, built to keep out acquisitive Nipponese Ronin, which had been torn down and made into a ring road. It was part of the Outer Kingdom, which meant that foreign devils were allowed as long as they were escorted by Chinese. Beyond it, deeper into the old neighborhood, was supposedly a scrap of the Middle Kingdom proper, the Celestial Kingdom, or CK as they like to call it, where no foreigners at all were allowed. An assistant took Hackworth as far as the border, where he stepped into the Chinese Coastal Republic, an entirely different country that comprised, among many other things, virtually all of Shanghai. As if to emphasize this, young men loitered on corners in Western clothes, listening to loud music, hooting at women, and generally ignoring their filial duties. He could have taken an auto rickshaw, which was the only vehicle other than a bicycle or skateboard narrow enough to negotiate the old streets, but you never could tell what kind of surveillance might be present in a Shanghai taxi. The departure of a new Atlantis gentleman from the flea circus late at night could only stimulate the imaginations of the gendarmes, who had intimidated the criminal element to such a degree that they were now feeling restless and looking for ways to diversify. Sages, seers, and theoretical physicists could only speculate at what, if any, relationship might exist between the Shanghai Police Department's astonishing scope of activities and actual law enforcement. Deplorable. But Hackworth was thankful for it as he sampled the French settlement's ramified backstreets. A handful of figures skulked across an intersection several blocks away, bloody light from a mediatron glancing off their patchwork nanobar outfits, the kind of thing only street criminals would need to wear. Hackworth comforted himself by reasoning that this must be a gang from one of the leased territories who had just come over the causeway. They wouldn't possibly be so rash as to assault a gentleman in the street, not in Shanghai. Hackworth detoured around the intersection anyway. Having never done anything illegal in his life, he was startled to understand, all of a sudden, that a ruthless constabulary was a crucial resource to more imaginative sorts of criminals, such as himself. Countless times that afternoon, Hackworth had been overcome by shame, and as many times he had fought it off with rationalization. What was so bad about what he was doing? He was not selling any of the new technologies that Lord Finkel McGraw had paid Bespoke to develop. He was not profiting directly. He was just trying to secure a better place in the world for his descendants, which was every father's responsibility. Old Shanghai was close to the Huangpu. The mandarins had once sat in their garden pavilions enjoying the river view. Within a few minutes, Hackworth had crossed a bridge into Pudong and was navigating narrow ravines between illuminated skyscrapers, heading for the coast a few miles farther to the east. Hackworth had been catapulted out of the rank and file and into Bespoke's elite ranks by his invention of the mediatronic chopstick. He'd been working in San Francisco at the time. The company was thinking hard about things Chinese, trying to one-up the Nipponese, who had already figured out a way to generate passable rice, 5 different varieties yet, direct from feed, bypassing the whole paddy coolie rat race, enabling 2 billion peasants to hang up their conical hats and get into some serious leisure time. And don't think for one moment that the Nipponese didn't already have some suggestions for what they might do with it. Some genius at headquarters, stewing over Nippon's prohibitive lead in nanotechnological rice production, decided the only thing for it was to leapfrog them by mass-producing entire meals, from wonton all the way to digital interactive fortune cookies. Hackworth got the seemingly trivial job of programming the matter compiler to extrude chopsticks. Now, doing this in plastic was idiotically simple. Polymers and nanotechnology went together like toothpaste and tubes. But Hackworth, who'd eaten his share of Chinese as a student, had never taken well to the plastic chopsticks, which were slick and treacherous in the blunt hands of a Guelo. Bamboo was better, and not that much harder to program if you just had a bit of imagination. Once he'd made that conceptual leap, it wasn't long before he came up with the idea of selling advertising space on the damn things, chopstick handles and Chinese columnar script being a perfect match. Before long, he was presenting it to his superiors, eminently user-friendly bamboy chopsters with colorful advertising messages continuously scrolling up their handles in real time, like news headlines in Times Square. For that, Hackworth was kicked upstairs to Bespoke and across the Pacific to Atlantis, Shanghai. He saw these chopsticks everywhere now. To the equity lords, the idea had been worth billions. To Hackworth, another week's paycheck. That was the difference between the classes, right there. He wasn't doing that badly compared to most other people in the world, but it still rankled him. He wanted more for Fiona. He wanted Fiona to grow up with some equity of her own, and not just a few pennies invested in common stocks, but a serious position in a major company. Starting your own company and making it successful was the only way. Hackworth had thought about it from time to time, but he hadn't done it. He wasn't sure why not. He had plenty of good ideas. Then he noticed that Bespoke was full of people with good ideas who'd never got around to starting their own companies. And he'd met a few big lords, spent considerable time with Lord Finkel McGraw developing Runcible, and seen that they weren't really smarter than he. The difference lay in personality, not in native intelligence. It was too late for Hackworth to change his personality, but it wasn't too late for Fiona. Before Finkel McGraw had come to him with the idea for Runcible, Hackworth had spent a lot of time pondering this issue, mostly while carrying Fiona through the park on his shoulders. He knew that he must seem distant to his daughter, though he loved her so, but only because when he was with her, he couldn't stop thinking about her future. How could he inculcate her with the nobleman's emotional stance, the pluck to take risks with her life, to found a company, perhaps found several of them, even after the first efforts had failed? He had read the biographies of several notable peers and found few common threads between them. Just when he was about to give up and attribute it all to random chance, Lord Finkel McGraw had invited him over to his club and, out of nowhere, begun talking about precisely the same issue. Finkel McGraw couldn't prevent his granddaughter Elizabeth's parents from sending her to the very schools for which he'd lost all respect. He had no right to interfere. It was his role as a grandparent to indulge and give gifts. But why not give her a gift that would supply the ingredient missing in those schools? It sounds ingenious, Hackworth had said, startled by Finkel McGraw's off-handed naughtiness. But what is that ingredient? I don't exactly know, Finkel McGraw had said, but as a starting point, I would like you to go home and ponder the meaning of the word subversive. Hackworth didn't have to ponder it for long, perhaps because he'd been toying with these ideas so long himself. The seed of this idea had been germinating in his mind for some months now, but had not bloomed, for the same reason that none of Hackworth's ideas had ever developed into companies. He lacked an ingredient somewhere, and as he now realized, that ingredient was subversiveness. Lord Alexander Chung-Sik Finkel McGraw, the embodiment of the Victorian establishment, was a subversive. He was unhappy because his children were not subversives, and was horrified at the thought of Elizabeth being raised in the stodgy tradition of her parents. So now he was trying to subvert his own granddaughter. A few days later, the gold pen on Hackworth's watch chain chimed. Hackworth pulled out a blank sheet of paper and summoned his mail. The following appeared on the page. The Raven, a Christmas tale told by a schoolboy to his little brothers and sisters, by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. 1798. Underneath an old oak tree, there was of swine a huge company that grunted as they crunched the mast. For that was ripe, and fell full fast. Then they trotted away, for the wind grew high. One acorn they left, and no more might you spy. Next came a raven, that liked not such folly. He belonged, they did say, to the witch Melancholy. Blacker was he than blackest jet, flew low in the rain, and his feathers not wet. He picked up the acorn and buried it straight by the side of a river both deep and great. Where then did the raven go? He went high and low, over hill, over dale did the black raven go. Many autumns, many springs traveled he with wandering wings, many summers, many winters, I can't tell half his adventures. At length he came back, and with him a she, and the acorn was grown to a tall oak tree. They built them a nest in the topmost bough, and young ones they had, and were happy enow. But soon came a woodman in leathern guise, his brow like a penthouse hung over his eyes. He'd an axe in his hand, not a word he spoke, but with many a hem and a sturdy stroke, at length he brought down the poor raven's own oak. His young ones were killed, for they could not depart, and their mother did die of a broken heart. The boughs from the trunk the woodmen did sever, and they floated it down on the course of the river. They sawed it in planks, and its bark they did strip, and with this tree and others they made a good ship. The ship, it was launched, but in sight of the land such a storm there did rise as no ship would withstand. It bulged on a rock, and the waves rushed in fast. Round and round flew the raven, and cawed to the blast. He heard the last shriek of the perishing souls. "See, see, o'er the topmast the mad water rolls!" Right glad was the raven, and off he went fleet, and death riding home on a cloud he did meet. And he thanked him again and again for this treat. They had taken his all, and revenge, it was sweet.
Mr. Hackworth, I hope the above poem illuminates the ideas I only touched on during our meeting of Tuesday last, and that it may contribute to your paramyological studies. Coleridge wrote it in a reaction to the tone of contemporary children's literature, which was didactic, much like the stuff they feed to our children in the best schools. As you can see, his concept of a children's poem is refreshingly nihilistic. Perhaps this sort of material might help to inculcate the sought-after qualities. I look forward to further conversations on the subject. Finkel McGraw.
This was only the starting point of development that had lasted for 2 years and culminated today. Christmas was just over a month away. 4-year-old Elizabeth Finkel McGraw would receive the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer from her grandfather. Fiona Hackworth would be getting a copy of the illustrated primer, too, for this had been John Percival Hackworth's crime. He had programmed the matter compiler to place the cockleburrs on the outside of Elizabeth's book. He had paid Dr. X to extract a terabyte of data from one of the cockleburrs. That data was, in fact, an encrypted copy of the matter compiler program that had generated the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer. He had paid Dr. X for the use of one of his matter compilers, which was connected to private sources owned by Dr. X and not connected to any feed. He had generated a second, secret copy of the primer. The cockleburrs had already self-destructed, leaving no evidence of his crime. Dr. X probably had a copy of the program on his computers, but it was encrypted, and Dr. X was smart enough simply to erase the thing and free up the storage, knowing that the encryption schemes apt to be used by someone like Hackworth could not be cracked without divine intervention. Before long, the streets widened, and the hush of tires on pavement blended with the buller of waves against the gradual shores of Pudong. Across the bay, the white lights of the New Atlantis clave rose up above the party-colored mosaic of the leased territories. It seemed a long way off, so on impulse, Hackworth rented a velocipede from an old man who had set up a stall in the lee of the causeway's thrust bearing. He rode out onto the causeway, and, invigorated by the cool, moist air on his face and hands, decided to pedal for a while. When he reached the arch, he allowed the bike's internal batteries to carry him up the slope. At the summit, he turned it off and began to coast down the other side, enjoying the speed. His top hat flew off. It was a good one, with a smart band that was supposed to make these mishaps a thing of the past, but as an engineer, Hackworth had never taken the manufacturer's promise seriously. Hackworth was going too fast to make a safe U-turn, and so he put on the brakes. When he finally got himself turned around, he was unable to see his hat. He did see another cyclist coming toward him. It was a young man, covered in a slick nanobar outfit, except for his head, which was smartly adorned with Hackworth's top hat. Hackworth was prepared to ignore this jape,
It was probably the only way the boy could safely get the hat down the hill, as prudence dictated keeping both hands on the handlebars. But the boy did not seem to be applying his brakes, and as he accelerated toward Hackworth, he actually sat up, taking both hands off the handlebars and gripped the brim of the hat with both hands. Hackworth thought the boy was preparing to throw it back as he went by, but instead he pulled it down onto his head and grinned insolently as he shot past.
"Say, stop right there! You have my hat!"
Hackworth shouted, but the boy did not stop. Hackworth stood astride his bicycle and watched unbelievingly as the boy began to fade into the distance. Then he turned on the bicycle's power assist and began chasing him. His natural impulse had been to summon the police, but since they were on the causeway, this would mean the Shanghai police again. In any case, they could not possibly have responded fast enough to catch this boy, who was well on his way to the end of the causeway, where he could fork off into any of the leased territories. Hackworth nearly caught him. Without the power assist, it would have been no contest, as Hackworth exercised daily in his club, while this boy had the pudgy, pasty look typical of thieves. But the boy had a considerable head start. By the time they reached the first ramp leading down into the leased territories, Hackworth was only 10 or 20 meters away, just close enough that he could not resist following the boy down the ramp. An overhead sign read, "Enchantment." They both picked up more speed on the ramp, and once again the boy reached up to grip the brim of the top hat. This time the bike's front wheel turned the wrong way. The boy erupted from the seat, the bicycle skittered into the irrelevant distance and clattered into something. The boy bounced once, rolled, and skidded for a couple of meters. The hat, its crown partially collapsed, rolled on its brim, toppled, and wobbled to a stop. Hackworth hit the brakes hard and overshot the boy for some distance. As before, it took him longer than he would have liked to get turned around. And then he knew for the first time that the boy was not alone, but part of a gang. Probably the same group he'd seen in Shanghai. That they'd followed him onto the causeway and taken advantage of his fallen top hat to lure him into the leased territories. And that the rest of the gang, 4 or 5 boys on bicycles, was coming toward him down the ramp, coming fast. And in the fog of light from all of the leased territories' mediatronic billboards glittered the chromium chains of their nunchucks. Miranda. How she became a Racta. Her early career. From the age of 5, Miranda wanted to be in a Ractive. In her early teens, after mother had taken her away from father and father's money, she'd worked as a maid of all work, chopping onions and polishing people's sterling silver salvers, cake combs, fish trowels, and grape shears. As soon as she got good enough with hair and makeup to pass for an 18-year-old, she worked as a governess for 5 years, which paid a little better. With her looks, she probably could have gotten a job as a lady's maid or parlor maid and become an upper servant, but she preferred the governess job. Whatever bad things her parents had done to her along the way, they had at least put her through some nice schools, where she'd learned to read Greek, conjugate Latin verbs, speak a couple of romance languages, draw, paint, integrate a few simple functions, and play the piano. Working as a governess, she could put it all to use. Besides, she preferred even bratty children to adults. When the parents finally dragged their worn-out asses home to give their children quality time, Miranda would run to her subterranean quarters and get into the cheapest, trashiest Ractive she could find. She wasn't going to make the mistake of spending all her money being in fancy Ractives. She wanted to be a payee, not a payer, and you could practice your Racting just as well in a dead shoot-'em-up as a live Shakespeare. As soon as she had saved up her yukus, she made the long-dreamed-of trip to the mod parlor, strode in with her jawline riding high as the hull of a clipper ship above a black turtleneck, looking very like a Ractor, and asked for the Jody. That turned a few heads in the waiting room. From there on in, it was all, "Very good, madam," and "Please make yourself comfortable here," and "Would you like tea, madam?" It was the first time since she and her mother had left home that anyone had offered her tea instead of ordering her to make some, and she knew perfectly well it would be the last time for several years, even if she got lucky. The tat machine worked on her for 16 hours. They dripped Valium into her arm so she wouldn't whine. Most tats nowadays went on like a slap on the back. "You sure you want the skull?" "Yeah, I'm sure." "Positive?" "Positive." "Okay." And splat. There was the skull, dripping blood and lymph, blasted through your epidermis with a wave of pressure that nearly knocked you out of the chair. But a dermal grid was a whole different thing, and a Jodi was top of the line. It had 100 times as many sites as the low-res grids sported by many a porn starlet, something like 10,000 of them in the face alone. The grossest part was when the machine reached down her throat to plant a trail of nanophones from her vocal cords all the way up to her gums. She closed her eyes for that one. She was glad she'd done it on the day before Christmas, because she couldn't have handled the kids afterward. Her face swelled up just like they said it would, especially around the lips and eyes where the sight density was greatest. They gave her creams and drugs, and she used them. The day after that, her mistress double-taked when Miranda came upstairs to fix the children breakfast. But she didn't say anything, probably assuming she'd gotten slapped around by a drunken boyfriend at a Christmas party, which was hardly Miranda's style, but it was a comfortable assumption for a new Atlantan woman to make. When her face had gotten back to looking exactly the same as it had before her trip to the tat parlor, she packed everything she owned into a carpet bag and took the tube into the city. The theater district had its good end and its bad end. The good end was exactly what and where it had been for centuries. The bad end was a vertical rather than a horizontal development, being a couple of old office skyscrapers now fallen into disreputable uses. Like many such structures, they were remarkably unpleasant to look at, but from the point of view of a Ractiv company, they were ideal. They had been designed to support a large number of people working side by side in vast grids of semi-private cubicles.
"Let's have a gander at your grid, sweetheart," said a man identifying himself as Mr. Fred, not my real name,
Epidermis, after he'd removed his cigar from his mouth and given Miranda a prolonged, methodical, full-body optical grope. "My grid ain't no sweetheart," she said. Sweetheart, TM, and Hero, TM, were the same grid as purveyed to millions of women and men, respectively. The owners didn't want to be Ractors at all, just to look good when they happened to be an Ractiv. Some were stupid enough to fall for the hype that one of these grids could serve as the portal to stardom. A lot of those girls probably ended up talking to Fred Epidermis.
"Oh, now I'm all curious," he said,
writhing just enough to make Miranda's lip curl.
"Let's put you on stage and see what you got."
The cubicles where his Ractors toiled were mere head stages. He had a few body stages, though, probably so he could bid on fully Ractiv porn. He pointed her toward one of these. She walked in, slammed the door, turned toward the wall-sized Mediatron, and got her first look at her new Jodi. Fred Epidermis had put the stage into constellation mode. Miranda was looking at a black wall speckled with 20,000 or 30,000 individual pricks of white light. Taken together, they formed a sort of three-dimensional constellation of Miranda, moving as she moved. Each point of light marked one of the sites that had been poked into her skin by the tat machine during those 16 hours. Not shown were the filaments that tied them all together into a network, a new bodily system overlaid and interlaced with the nervous, lymph, and vascular systems.
"Holy shit! Got a fucking Hepburn or something here!"
Fred Epidermis was exclaiming, watching her on a second monitor outside the stage. "It's a Jodi," she said. But she stumbled over the words as the field of stars moved, tracking the displacements of her jaw and lips. Outside, Fred Epidermis was wielding the editing controls, zooming in on her face, which was dense as a galactic core. By comparison, her arms and legs were wispy nebulas, and the back of her head nearly invisible, with a grand total of maybe 100 sites placed around her scalp, like the vertices of a geodesic dome. The eyes were empty holes, except, she imagined, when she closed her eyes. Just to check it out, she winked into the Mediatron. The sights on her eyelids were dense as grass blades on a putting green, but accordion together except when the lid expanded over the eye. Fred Epidermis recognized the move and zoomed in so violently on her winking eye that she nearly threw herself back on her ass. She could hear him chortling.
"You'll get used to it, honey," he said. "Just hold still so I check the sights on your lips."
He panned to her lips, rotated them this way and that, as she puckered and pursed. She was glad they'd drugged her out of her mind while they were doing the lips, thousands of nanosites in there.
"Looks like we got ourselves an artiste here," Fred Epidermis said. "Let me try you in one of our most challenging roles."
Suddenly a blonde, blue-eyed woman was standing in the Mediatron, perfectly aping Miranda's posture, wearing big hair, a white sweater with a big letter F in the middle, and a preposterously short skirt. She was carrying big, colored, puffy things. Miranda recognized her from old passives she'd seen on the Mediatron as an American teenager from the previous century.
"This is Spirit, a little old-fashioned to you and me, but popular with tube feeders," said Fred Epidermis. "Course, your grid's way overkill for this, but hey, we're about giving the customer what they want, moving those bids, you know."
But Miranda wasn't really listening. For the first time ever, she was watching another person move exactly as she moved, as the stage mapped Miranda's grid onto this imaginary body. Miranda pressed her lips together as if she'd just put on lipstick, and Spirit did the same. She winked, and Spirit winked. She touched her nose, and Spirit got a face full of pom-pom.
"Let's run you through a scene," said Fred Epidermis.
Spirit vanished and was replaced by an electronic form with blanks for names, numbers, dates, and other data. He flashed through it before Miranda could really read it. They didn't need a contract for a dry run. Then she saw Spirit again, this time from two different camera angles. The Mediatron had split up into several panes. One was a camera angle on Spirit's face, which still did whatever Miranda's face did. One was a two-shot showing Spirit and an older man standing in a room full of big machines. Another pane showed a close-up of the old man who, as Spirit realized, was being played by Fred Epidermis. The old man said,
"Okay, keep in mind we usually play this through a head stage, so you don't control Spirit's arms and legs, just a face."
"How do I walk around?" Miranda said.
Spirit's lips moved with hers, and from the Mediatron came Spirit's voice, squeaky and breathy at the same time. The stage was programmed to take the feeds from the nanophones in her throat and disp them into a different envelope.
"You don't. Computer decides where you go when. Our dirty little secret. This isn't really that reactive, it's just a plot tree. But it's good enough for our clientele, because all of the leaves of the tree, the ends of the branches, you understand, are exactly the same, namely what the payer wants. You follow?" "Well, you'll see," said the old man on the screen, reading Miranda's confusion in Spirit's face.
What looked like guarded skepticism on Miranda came across as bubble-brained innocence on Spirit.
"Cue! Follow the fucking cues! This isn't improv workshop!" shouted the old man.
Miranda checked the other panes on the display. One, she reckoned, was a map of the room, showing her location and the old man's, with arrows occasionally pulsing in the direction of movement. The other was a prompter, with a line waiting for her, flashing red.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Willie," she said. "I know school's out, and you must be very tired after a long day of teaching shop to all of those nasty boys. But I was wondering if I could ask you for a big, big favor."
"Certainly, go ahead, whatever," said Fred Epidermis through the face and body of Mr. Willie, not even pretending to emote.
"Well, it's just that I have this appliance that's very important to me, and it seems to have broken. I was wondering if you knew how to fix one of these," Miranda said.
On the Mediatron, Spirit said the same thing, but Spirit's hand was moving. She was holding something up next to her face. An elongated, glossy white plastic thing. A vibrator.
"Well," said Mr. Willie, "it's a scientific fact that all electrical devices work on the same principles, so in theory I should be able to help you. But I must confess, I've never seen an appliance quite like that one. Would you mind explaining what it is and what it does?"
"I'd be more than happy to," said Miranda.
But then the display froze, and Fred Epidermis cut her off by shouting through the door,
"Enough already," he said. "I just had to make sure you could read."
He opened the stage door and said,
"You're hired. Cubicle 238. My commission is 80%. The dormitory's upstairs. Pick your own bunk and clean it out. You can't afford to live anywhere else."
Harv brings Nell a present. She experiments with the primer.
When Harv came back home, he was walking with all of his weight on one foot. When the light struck the smudges on his face in the right way, Nell could see streaks of red mixed in with the dirt and the toner. He was breathing fast, and he swallowed heavily and often, as though throwing up were much on his mind. but he was not empty-handed. His arms were crossed tightly across his belly. He was carrying things in his jacket.
"I made out now," he said, seeing his sister's face and knowing that she was too scared to talk first. "Didn't get much, but got some. Got some stuff for the flea circus."
Nell wasn't sure what the flea circus was, but she had learned that it was good to have stuff to take there, that Harv usually came back from the flea circus with an access code for a new Reactive. Harv shouldered the light switch on and kneeled in the middle of the room before relaxing his arms, lest some small thing fall out and be lost in a corner. Nell sat in front of him and watched. He took out a piece of jewelry, swinging ponderously at the end of a gold chain. It was circular, smooth gold on one side and white on the other. The white side was protected under a flattened glass dome. It had numbers written around the edge, and a couple of slender metal things like daggers, one longer than the other, joined at their hilts in the center. It made a noise like mice trying to eat their way through a wall in the middle of the night. Before she could ask about it, Harv had taken out other things. He had a few cartridges from his mite trap. Tomorrow Harv would take the cartridge down to the flea circus and find out if he'd caught anything, and whether it was worth money. There were other things like buttons, but Harv saved the biggest thing for last, and he withdrew it with ceremony.
"I had to fight for this, Nell," he said. "I fought hard because I was afraid the others would break it up for parts. I'm giving it to you."